everybody. This is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
Thought I was going to forget my name, didn't you? That momentary look on your face. Welcome to the Invested Podcast, and we hope you guys are enjoying this series of, investing education. And we're going to just keep on rolling. Some of the things that Buffett's done in the past and does a lot now that are not well known in the public, but we should talk about it.
Amazing. Can we just have like a conclusory, is that a word? Paragraph about the end of the checklist series. We are done with checklists.
Yes.
I'm leaving aside the topic of my notes for a while. I'm working on through it as I slowly get better here. And at some point we'll come back and we'll talk about my process and see what you think of it. But I think let's leave checklists for now.
Okay. And let's talk about the two extremes of Warren Buffett's strategies. We've been in the middle of a strategy in the bullseye for years, and we haven't really talked much about the things that are on the extreme ends of this sort of bell curve of investing strategy.
Ooh, and, intriguing.
And one end of it is that Warren Buffett is one of the largest in terms of volume stock options traders in the world, and very few people are aware of that. And we may have time to get to that today a little bit, what that's all about and how you might use that or how you might not use that. And the other end of the extreme is what he did for his initial strategies as he just kind of came out from Columbia University, having studied under Ben Graham, and tried to get a job with Graham and failed. Graham wouldn't hire him. Mm-hmm. And then Warren just persisted and got a job. And those initial years, he followed Ben Graham's strategies very closely in what Graham called the net-net strategy. Net-net. Did you already know this? This net-net thing?
I've heard the term. I don't really know what it is. I wouldn't be able to explain it or talk about it, but I've heard the term a number of times. In relation to various investors, not just Buffett. Isn't there another one that really likes net nets? Or maybe it's just a Graham version, a Graham philosophy.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's an interesting concept that came out of the Depression and World War II. He actually developed it in the Depression.
But before you tell me what it is, I just want to make sure I'm clear. So both sides of the extremes are one side is stock options and the other side is these net nets. Yes?
Yeah, I think that's
right. Got it. Okay.
I think that's right. Net nets are super conservative, super, super, super conservative stock investing. And options are traditionally thought to be a very risky type of stock investing.
Yeah, absolutely. To the point where you have to get specially approved by your brokerage.
Exactly. So let's start with the really conservative one. This goes all the way back into the mid-50s when Buffett came out of Columbia and started on his own. And Graham had devised this idea of investing back in the 1930s when he actually got out of the stock market in 1929 before the crash and was liquid. And then the market crashed down. But of course, you don't have this crystal ball. And this is a really good thing for everybody to keep in mind as we come up on what Ray Dalio thinks is going to be a similar, you know, it's like, it won't rhyme, but it's in the ballpark of the Depression.
Like history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Yeah.
Okay, it won't exactly rhyme.
I just butchered Mark Twain, I think. Right. History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. So I think he's looking for the rhyme here. Dalio is, to the 1930s depression, where the country went through this kind of cataclysmic devaluation of the U.S. dollar, and ultimately ended up in World War II. So, in anticipation of that possibility, I don't know that he thinks it's likely, but I think he thinks it's a strong possibility. Then we should think about what net-net is, because net-net was what Graham did in the Depression. And it was very, very successful. Essentially, the idea is to value...
Man, laying down the important info here, Dad. This is like exciting.
You having fun?
Okay, yeah. Good.
Well, the
I was the basic... not expecting this today. Go for it.
The basic thing with net-net is that you're trying to buy the company just for almost for its cash that's sitting there. You want to actually buy it for a discount to cash. It's almost what net-net is. Essentially, you take all of the current assets. That means the cash and the cash equivalents, right? You'll see they have some money and some short-term investments that we call cash equivalents. You add that to accounts receivable, but you reduce accounts receivable if you think there's a good chance a lot of it won't get collected. Obviously,
so basically cash that's readily available and cash that's readily collectible or
right.
legitimately collectible.
Right. And then you take the inventory, which is in your assets on the balance sheet, and you reduce that to just what you'd get if you liquidated it. Fire sale.
So not the same as book value, because that encompasses the whole
a lot of stuff.
Value of the business that you could sell it off for. But well, it
doesn't really. Book value is what is an accounting number. It really should be what you could sell it off for net, but it isn't. There's a lot of intangibles that are there in the assets that you really can't count on.
Yeah, I think I'm using the wrong words, but that's what I mean, that there's a lot of intangibles in book value that conceivably could be sellable, but in real life usually are not.
Yeah,
so
exactly. Especially if you're under pressure and
right.
things aren't going well. So you really reduce the assets to just what you're absolutely going to get out of it in a conservative view if you liquidated everything and you get that number. So let's say it's $100. And then you subtract all of the liabilities from that. Now let's say liabilities are $50. So now you've got $50 left over. That's net. That's what they call net. And that $50, you want to buy the stock for roughly 80% of that $50. So about $40.
So not even for that amount.
Still
a discount.
And that's what, a discount to the discount.
So that's from Graham?
From Graham.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Net. And there are people who pursue a net strategy. You can look it up on Google, and I'm sure there's somebody out there that would be happy to take you under their wing and teach you net. I don't know if they're actually the real or not, but it's certainly a very famous strategy for investing. It's just that when Buffett came out and began doing it, very quickly he started to realize that this wasn't the 30s anymore. This was the late 1950s. And it became really hard to find things where you're basically getting it for free, right? And that's when Charlie Munger came along, right around 1959, 1960, and said, hey, Warren, really, you should be thinking that we'd rather have a wonderful company at a fair price than a fair company at a wonderful price.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's almost like Buffett was struggling in between this Grahamian philosophy of trying to buy anything as long as it's cheap and you know you're getting it for really, really cheap. That's a great investment. Go ahead and buy it. And yet he couldn't find a lot of stuff like that. So that's a struggle. And then Munger came around and was like, oh, all of that? Like, let's not do that. Let's buy things for more. But make sure they're really good. So like the exact opposite of what Graham taught him, which because Graham didn't care if it was a good company or not, as long as it was cheap.
And Graham bought quite a lot of these things, you guys. When you do a net thing, you don't buy 10 of these. He would buy 200 of these. And, you know, some of them would go down and enough of them would go up as people started to realize the company's not going to fail, that he made very, very good money. He was compounding money at 22% through the Depression and World War II. That's just extraordinary. And built up what would today be a multi-billion dollar portfolio. But as you said, Danielle, in the 60s, late 50s and 60s, it wasn't that way at all. In fact, the market was getting more and more overpriced, such that by 1965, the market peaked at about 1,000 on the Dow, and it didn't go above that for the next 18 years.
Wow.
It got so high priced.
Wow.
So it's just real interesting to know that Warren started off with net, that it is a viable strategy if everything just really hits the fan, and or if you're in another country where things are hitting the fan. Like, for example, in Turkey right now, there's this huge devaluation of the lira, and that is going to make some things incredibly cheap in Turkey. If you can take a look at that, maybe you'd be interested in a net kind of point of view. Or in Argentina, where things are really dicey right now, they're looking at another major devaluation. So you look where there's real trouble economically across the board, looking for companies that are likely to survive, and then buying them just super cheap because nobody wants to own stocks. That you'd be in that environment. If nobody wants to own Argentine stocks or nobody wants to own Turkish stocks, right, then you're going to have a massive sell-off to a point of really stupidity, right? That you can go and buy viable companies for less than essentially the cash on their books. So that's kind of interesting.
I mean, it's because people need the money, obviously.
Yeah, it's because people need the money and they're scared. Even the people who don't need the money are looking for something else, right? And this is where...
Yeah, maybe so.
Not to slide into a whole nother controversial subject, but this is where gold became the preeminent investment strategy in the 1930s when people were very afraid of what was going to happen with the currency of all countries. All of the first world countries were in real dire straits, a lot of problems in the streets. And so gold became very, very important. And the United States took action on an executive order from FDR. It didn't pass it through Congress. They didn't do anything. He just executive order. Made gold illegal to own in the United States for a citizen to own it. And I'm mentioning that because today the modern equivalent of a gold position might be something like Bitcoin or Ethereum, some sort of, not a cryptocurrency per se, but an actual blockchain-based crypto. And that, I just think, be really careful in terms of thinking that because you're putting your money into Bitcoin, it's going to be safe, when governments tend to be very aggressive about protecting their currencies. And it could very well be that other countries follow China's lead and India's lead. They've both made crypto illegal as a currency. So other countries follow that lead, you're going to find yourself in something that's highly volatile, very difficult to be able to actually benefit from.
It's super interesting because the concept behind Bitcoin is a currency free of control by a government.
Right.
And yet we are seeing controls by governments.
Right.
So
theoretically.
The argument is you hold Bitcoin because it's, or any, whichever one ends up being, a valuable one in the far future, because it's not gettable, because, no bank has to submit your information, except that now that everyone's doing it through banks, and it's becoming so mainstream and establishment and standardized. And
It's really be interesting to see where
it goes.
I
really would like an expert to explain to me. Maybe we should try to find somebody to come on and who's a mega.
We're going to get some substantially different opinions on this thing.
Yeah,
I can tell you that.
That's true. That's true.
So it would be fascinating because so many people are. I wouldn't say they're investing. I say they're gambling with Bitcoin because it's an interesting gamble, right?
Exactly.
So anyway, didn't want to get all off on the Bitcoin here, but
as you were talking about the different investing strategies, the net, and then the way Buffett changed, what came to mind is that it's almost like, and I'm curious your impression on this because you're very committed to the Buffett Rule 1 method, it's almost like maybe you need a slightly different strategy, not slightly, maybe you need a different strategy depending on the economic situation / market situation in a given time period. What do you think about that?
I don't know that I would agree. I think that that Graham's idea was that it was difficult to pick winners, and therefore you pick a lot of companies based not on whether they're going to be winners in the long run, but whether they have more value than you paid for them in a desperately terrible scenario.
Yeah.
So
and you pick lots of them because a lot of them are going to not make it.
Yeah, exactly. So Buffett called this cigar butt investing, right? You're picking up cigar butts off the ground that have a few puffs in them, but they're virtually free. Mm-hmm. And you can see why they acted like they're free. You're buying the company for less than the liquidation value of the company. So they're kind of free in that way. Of course, you can't count on the company being liquidated. And that's something really important for you all to understand is that one of the just sort of the rules of these companies is when a company gets in trouble, the management team will have every incentive in the world to burn every dollar they can burn to stay in their jobs as long as possible, even to the point of staying in their job through bankruptcy and a restructuring and maybe come out with their jobs on the other side of it, even though there's no longer any investors from the original stock. So don't count on a company. One of the tough things about net-net is that you sort of almost count on the company actually liquidating, which they will never do. They will not liquidate. The people running it have too much of a vested interest in just getting that paycheck until there's no more money. So it's really theoretical that you could actually get your hands on it. And that's
well,
one of the
I
big
mean,
problems.
Some of them
it.
Will sell, you know, and then you'll get some money from
they'll
that.
Get bought out by another company for something more than that, right?
Exactly.
But
that's
at the end
the
of
exit.
The day,
it's like a VC and it's a VC investment. What's your exit? There's only a few exits. Yeah, IPO, sell the company, or it fails and you get nothing. That's an exit too. And if the company's already public, it's already IPO'd, so that one's out. So the only other option is it sells.
It could sell to a public company or it could sell to a private group of investors, but it gets moved to a different management structure.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the,
or they recover it and you hold stock in a lovely company.
Yeah, they could recover. And that is not so much what Graham was trying to do.
No.
But it was very much what Buffett did and would, I believe, continue to do. Because think about it. If you can buy just mediocre companies for, you know, a discount to their cash, that likely means that really good companies are out there also at a big discount. But the difference is these companies have a future. You're talking about major companies that are actually doing well. Maybe in the 1930s, you're talking about oil companies and AT&T, right? As America expands through the telephone out there, companies that would be building out the infrastructure of America in the 40s. Gosh, let's see what else. Defense companies, right? Coming into
World War II.
So you have companies that were extremely anti-fragile through the Depression. This is when Coca-Cola was crushing it. Movie companies were crushing it as people were looking for inexpensive entertainment and something that made them feel better. Perfume companies.
Yeah. Makeup.
Yeah, absolutely. Crushed it through the Depression. So using Buffett's strategy, I think it's more likely you could find really good companies than any other time, actually. And that's what my experience was in 2009. And as the market crashed down, you saw so many good companies. I hate to beat a drum on Chipotle, but we haven't bought that many companies, so it's hard to say it over and over again. I apologize. But Chipotle was compounding their growth rate at 20% a year through 2009. I mean, that was like everybody's out there getting crushed. The economy was down. We're in a big recession, almost a freeze up of the financial system. And here's Chipotle just killing it. People coming in to get burritos who would have been going to Olive Garden, right? So Olive Garden got smoked.
Yeah.
Right? That whole group of companies got wiped. And Chipotle just did great. So you got to look for companies that are anti-fragile for this kind of thing. And if you do, I like them better than net-net by far. It's just so much easier.
How do you combine those two? It sounds like what you're saying is you don't switch, but maybe you bring a little flavor of the net-net in a certain downturn situation.
I think the biggest thing you're bringing over is a lot of skepticism about where the bottom is for this company's stock. And this is, I was going to say, this is where Graham made a ghastly mistake, and one that would be very easy to understand. And that is, he got out when he saw everything was massively overvalued in 1929, which was amazing. And then he got back in 1930 as the market crashed down. So when the market's down 50%, he's like, this is just the best thing in the world. But it went down to 90% down.
So I didn't know that he started buying that early.
Yeah. So it was a real lesson on, and that's, I think, generated the idea of net-net, is that he couldn't trust where the bottom was on good companies because the market sold off everything.
That's super interesting.
Yeah.
Because gosh, it's just impossible to know. It's impossible to know.
Where the bottom is.
Yeah. He's thinking, like, by every standard I've ever lived through, this is excellent pricing for good companies that are going to make it out of this.
Yep.
And then it just keeps going.
Right.
And he's, can you just imagine the torture of watching that thing go down? Like, there's a certain amount of, like, I love how you talk about appreciating when a company continues to go down in price because, okay, yay, I get to buy more. This is why we do tranches so that you don't want to kill yourself when it starts to go down more. And yet you're sitting there, you've spent all your tranche, like all your money's in. And keeps going.
It's very frustrating. I mean, the market didn't get back to the 1929 high until 1955. So you're going to think about, if you bought stocks in 1929,
it's an absolute lifetime
of zero return, unless you were clipping, getting dividends, right? And ultimately in the 1930s, that was what was left of market interest, was people started to realize or started to believe that the only value of a company was the dividends that it produced, that you couldn't trust any other part of the value. Actually, this is really good to talk about this right now.
Yeah, it really is.
Obviously, nobody's thinking that way today. It's just all about, you know, somebody's going to pay more for it than I did, which is total speculation, right?
Yeah.
And which kind of leads us to the opposite extreme.
But wait, can I just say one more thing about that?
Oh, sure, sure.
What jumped to mind is that it's a lot like the housing market.
Yes.
To buy a house that you're planning as an investment property to rent out. And what a lot of people will say to themselves these days is, oh, you know, the rent's not really going to totally cover the mortgage, or it's not totally going to be exactly what I want because, like, whatever, reason. But it should go up over time. And, you know, in the next 20 years, I'll make money from it. But that is not necessarily how it's going to be. And so the analogy I hear is, make sure that the rent is going to sustain you, because the actual value, the price you could sell it for, may not.
Yeah, people get caught, by the way, if you're into real estate investing, you might beware that I watched so many real estate investors get caught in the middle 1980s as interest rates just went up and up and up. I know there were some guys that were the dad of a friend of mine who's a bunch of doctor partners, and they own the building. They decided to sell the building. They sold the building and carried a 16% mortgage back.
Jeez.
That's where mortgages were on commercial buildings. They carried a 16% mortgage. And then they decided they didn't want the risk of the mortgage. So they factored it. Or I forget what they call it. They sold the mortgage. And there, a market grew up around these high price mortgages, or these high interest rate mortgages, to discount them, and the buyers would get even more on it, right? When you take the discount into effect. So if you, let's say you had a $100,000 mortgage and you were paying 16, you were getting 16%. So you're getting $16,000 a year, and then you sell that mortgage for $80,000.
Oh, I thought you meant they owed 16%, but you're saying they were receiving. Okay.
And they sold that mortgage. Let's say they discounted it to, what did I just say? 16. So for 100,000 mortgage, let's say they sold it for 80,000, right? So they're willing to take 80. And the person that bought the mortgage takes on the risk that they may have to take over the property. but they're also getting 20%. $16,000 on $80,000 is 20%. So now they're getting a 20% return per year. Can you imagine? I mean, if that starts to come back again, you're going to see me jumping on some mortgages, because 20% a year compounded is deep. Well, it's not compounded. I got to take the money in and then do something with it. Right. You understand the difference?
Like, I think so, but why don't you tell me just to make sure?
Okay. So it's an important distinction. If I put my money into, let's say, Apple Computer, and they're compounding my money at 20% a year, they're compounding it every year. They're making 20% on the growing pile.
Right? Yeah. So they're including, and the growing the pile is not ever going down.
No, it goes up, up, it goes up, 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 and up, and up. Right?
Yeah.
And so pretty soon, you know, in 3 or 4 years, that pile has doubled. My money has doubled inside of Apple. And then they keep going another 3.5 years, it's doubled again. And another 3.5 years, it's doubled again. So, and that is, should be reflected in the stock price, right? But what's going on? Or they're going to distribute a massive pile of cash at some point, or, you know, or they're going to buy back a massive amount of stock. So they're going to get me my capital, or they're going to use it to grow, one or the other. And it's like phenomenal. And that's compounding. That means the money is growing and the growth rate is being applied to last year's growth as well.
Yeah, it's growing on itself. So the money from last year then grows again with the 20%. But you're saying this is different with the
building. It's different when you're receiving money from a bond, from a mortgage note. So if these guys bought that note, that $100,000 note, and they paid $80,000 for it, now they're getting $16,000 each year, maybe paid out monthly or annually or whatever, but they're getting that $16,000. It is not compounding at $16,000. It's not compounding.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
A year.
The 20% stays on the 80. It doesn't go up every year.
It doesn't, it's not applied to the $16,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you collect that. Now you got to do something with it. And this is actually the problem with dividends. If a company has a choice between paying a dividend or using the money to grow the company, assuming it's a legitimate choice, I would much rather have them grow the company if they can grow the company at a high rate of return, right? Let's say they're doing a 15% return on invested capital. If they will keep that money and grow and continue to grow that at 15%, I would much rather have them do that than give it to me. Now I got to go find a place to put it. So
I agree. You know, I mean, we had long talks about that, and I completely agree.
Yeah.
And I think the choices that CEOs, that leaders of companies, that boards make around that is our biggest clue, piece of evidence,
right,
into
clue.
How they think about that capital coming in and what they can do with it. And yep. I mean, I wrote about it in our book and Invested, about the dividend contract of expectations that putting out a dividend every year creates. But it's not just putting out the dividend. It's an expectation that that dividend's going to grow every year. And if it doesn't, then something terribly is wrong and people flee the company in droves, even though the company's doing just fine and they only just like put out the same as last year. Oh, no. Yeah.
Well, as you wrote, you know, it's so upside down from the way you should think about it, right? You don't want a company that is locked into paying a dividend no matter what, including borrowing the money to do so and ignoring possibilities for growth or restructuring their business or being prepared
for a pandemic or pandemic part two or pandemic part three or whatever we've got coming down the pike here.
I mean, look what happened to all these airlines. They were rolling in cash.
Yeah.
And they just bought back their stock or paid out dividends, and then they
had no
money.
Can you believe there were airlines doing so well that Warren Buffett bought some of them?
Right.
That is insane.
And then he got burned. Oh,
and
my God.
He got super burned.
Buffett's like, next time I do that, somebody shoot me. Yeah. But that's 100% why, 100% biggest clue to the allocation skills of the CEO. And ultimately, that's going to matter a great deal. You watched Jenny Rometty at IBM just have terrible, terrible allocation skills, putting the money into the wrong things, burning money by buying back stock that ultimately doesn't increase the stock price at all. And it just, it really was sad. And she just made a 10-year hole in IBM's future. Meanwhile, Microsoft comes in with a much smarter CEO. You know, Jenny Rometty's a salesperson. And Microsoft brings in a technology guy and just goes, hey, let's take this to the next level. And they did. And they went out and successfully competed with Amazon in the cloud. Which is what IBM's been trying to do and has done it unsuccessfully for 10
Massive
years.
Massive success.
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to go. So let's talk next time about
the other extreme.
The other extreme.
Of Warren
and
Buffett.
I am loving that we're talking about this because we haven't talked about dividends and stuff for a while.
Very cool. All right. See you next time, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Time to go play.
Bye.
Bye. Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com and sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding. They really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And really important, it's not to be taken as investing advice because I am not your financial advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really hope you enjoyed it.